Last week, when we finished off with the end of chapter 3, I kind of described the end of chapter 3 as a preliminary conclusion to this whole section, which is dealing with these two themes. Paul has just been just hammering away at these two ideas of, first of all, the disagreements in Corinth over who the real servants of God were. But then also, behind that, the second topic of the Corinthians' trust in and respect for and delight in human abilities and human wisdom that their disagreements revealed. And his conclusion with the deeper question of wisdom was that if anyone wants to do the wise thing, then he or she will abandon all those human ways of thinking and reasoning and doing life, choosing to become a fool in the eyes of the world in order to learn true wisdom at the feet of God. And then his conclusion concerning those superficial issues of pride and following different teachers was to insist that those Christian heroes they follow are actually only servants, right? Working for their good, that apostles weren't important, they were the ones that were important, but that even they themselves, in turn, only exist for God's purposes. So you may remember those were the things that came out last week. And I called them preliminary conclusions because they're still general, abstract teaching, right? I mean, obviously with implications for what's going on in Corinth, but he's still talking in the abstract. And now in chapter 4, Paul takes the gloves off, and he deals very directly, applying those two conclusions very specifically to the way the Corinthians have been treating him. So first, in the passage we're looking at today, which is chapter 4, verses 1 through 5, he applies the truth that ministers are merely servants, but servants of God, that it's God's project. And Paul says that since apostles and other teachers are only servants, it doesn't matter what anyone thinks about them, except the one that they serve, which is God alone. That's what we're going to be looking at today. And then next week, we'll take a longer passage, most of chapter 4, verses 6 through 17. And there, Paul's going to apply the truth of becoming fools in the eyes of the world in order to find true wisdom. And he's going to do that by contrasting the apparent success of the Corinthians' lives with the apparent failure of his own life to give a very startling real-life picture of what it looks like to become a fool in order to become wise. So this is 1 Corinthians 4, verses 1 through 5. So then, men ought to regard us as servants of God, and as those entrusted with the secret things of God. Now, it's required that those who've been given a trust must prove faithful. I care very little if I am judged by you or any human court. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that doesn't make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, George, judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait till the Lord comes. He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of men's hearts. At that time, each will receive his praise from God. The word of God for the people of God. So then, points back to the end of chapter 3, right, that we just were remembering, where Paul said that the apostles, rather than being some sort of special, gifted, great men among whom people could like pick out their favorite, like their like some favorite pop star, that the apostles were in fact merely servants, working on the very precious project of the Corinthian believers themselves. But that didn't put the Corinthians in charge, the fact that they were kind of the goal, because the Corinthians were God's project. right? So he says that if someone gets that, if someone really understands that truth, then they will recognize the apostles and other teachers to a similar but lesser degree as servants of Christ and as those entrusted with the secret things of God. And of course, those two descriptions recall a whole bunch that Paul has already said. You may remember earlier in these chapters, we had a whole section about the mystery, right, that was entrusted, this idea that it was what God had revealed. And Paul and Apollos and the other apostles, turns out, are nothing in and of themselves. They're merely servants given a task. But the honor and dignity of that task that has been given to them demands that they be treated with a certain respect and dignity. Although they are nothing in and of themselves, their servant, their dignity or respect as a servant comes from what it is that they serve, right? And here he says they are servants, but of Christ, okay? Now, when he says those entrusted, that idea of something being entrusted to somebody kind of is the idea of a steward, but in the older sense, you know, if when I say steward, you think of an airline worker, that's not what we're talking about. A steward is nothing in and of himself, and he doesn't have anything of his own, but he's given something extremely valuable to take care of for whom it belongs to. Right? So, and this is, of course, going back to what Paul said earlier about the mystery of the gospel being something that no one could have ever figured out, but that God has, in fact, revealed. And you may recall that back then, Paul was speaking very specifically, not that it's just been revealed to the world or to the church at large, but Paul was talking about how the gospel mystery had been revealed specifically to the apostles, that this revelation of the mystery of the gospel was entrusted to them. They themselves were and remain nothing, but God has put something absolutely precious, something on which the future of the world, the future of God's plan for the world, depends. And he has put it in their hands so that they need to be treated with the dignity that is owed to what they carry. If you're in London and you're on the subway and it's crowded and you bump into somebody and he stumbles a little bit, it's no big deal, okay? But once that guy gets to work at Buckingham Palace and puts on the really fancy uniform and picks up the pillow with the crown jewels on it to carry it into the throne room, if you bump him, it's a really big deal. The apostles and other teachers are nothing, but they have been entrusted with the gospel revelation of who God is and what he's doing for us. Now with that, Paul then begins to shift the topic a bit with the next line. And this whole kind of insisting that there's this the kind of this that this really important task that's been entrusted to the apostles is really setting him up for this. He says, now, it's required, just in general out there in the world, that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. Right? This is he's just common sense. Everybody nods and says, yeah. Okay? Before you turn your life savings over to an investment manager, right, you want to make sure that he knows what he's doing. That he's not just going to be honest, but that he's actually going to be able to do what it is that you're entrusting him to do. Right? And that's kind of important because often when we talk about faithful in church, all we simply mean is sincere. Right? All we usually really mean is that we are wholehearted or committed. But here, the use of faithful involves this idea of also fit, capable. The idea here is that a steward has to be more than simply sincere and honest. He actually has to be up to the task. Before you give your money to that investor, you want to know that he's honest, but you also want to see that he can actually do what it is that you want done. And so when Paul makes this point that those to whom the gospel is entrusted need it's important that they actually be fit for that task. I can easily imagine the Corinthians thinking, yes, Paul, that's just what we've been wanting to talk to you about. It isn't just anybody who's up to representing God. And honestly, you're just not up to this task the way that some of these other guys are. You're a great guy and all. But leading people to God is really important stuff. Conveying to people God's dignity. Conveying to people God's greatness. Conveying to people God's wisdom and power. You know, you don't really strike people that way. You're not that caliber. Really, Paul, I mean, take a look in the mirror. You look like one of those guys down in the market sewing tents for a living. And have you ever listened to one of your own sermons? My 12-year-old son knows more about public speaking. You'll always be dear to us. But the gospel work really deserves someone better. And that's the kind of thinking in Corinth that Paul is responding to when he goes on and he says, but I care very little if I am judged by you or by anyone else. Okay, we again have this word judge that came up earlier, a month or so ago, we talked about it. And the problem is that judge has, in the biblical word for judge, has a ton of different uses. And we tend to use it, especially when we're reading the Bible, because we're already kind of making some assumptions, we tend to use judge meaning simply condemn. And that's not what it's here. Here it doesn't mean to pass judgment, right? Here it's the judge in the sense of to examine, to appraise, to look into the matter thoroughly and come to some sort of conclusion, whatever that conclusion might be. And of course, here the inquiry and the conclusion would be whether Paul is really fit to be entrusted with the gospel. Is he really the best one to entrust with the project of building the Corinthians into the temple of God? Paul says, yes, it's absolutely critical that a minister of the gospel be fit for the task, but you are not the ones that get to make that call. You are not the ones who are fit to investigate this matter. In fact, he says, no human being gets to make that call, since, as he's been hitting over and over again, we're talking about servants of God. And Paul actually goes a step further to insist that not even he himself has any right to inquire as to his own fitness. And this is what we all do, right? You may think immediately of kind of Moses when he's called and saying, no, send someone better than me, right? But we do the same thing every time a need pops up in the church. Everybody, you know, whether it's sincere or whether they're just trying to defend themselves, thinking, oh, who would be the right person for this? Instead of just quietly listening, is God calling me? No one is fit to examine themselves and come to any conclusions as to whether they're fit for the task. And why? Because God is the one who calls, and when God calls, the only acceptable response is to trust and obey, regardless of how fit you might think yourself. Now, Paul is quick to clear up that he doesn't think he's unfit, right? He says, not that I have anything against myself. Indeed, he says, my conscience is clear, right? If I were to investigate the matter, I wouldn't have any marks against myself. But he says, but that has nothing to do with it. That's not what makes me pass the test. The fact that he feels himself fit for ministry means no more than the fact that the Corinthians think him unfit. His clean conscience is not grounds for his servants, because that would again mean that a human being is the one who's sufficient to make the call about who does what for God. The only one who has any right to inquire, investigate, come to conclusions, and approve or disapprove is God himself. Verse 4. it is the Lord who judges me. And again, here, judge is not looking at the final judgment. Let's pull up Paul's life and see everything he did right and wrong. That's not. It's this judging in the question of, is this person fit to serve the gospel? And however much we might be eager when it says it's the Lord that judges me, however eager we may be to see God show up when we're dealing with some question and declare what he thinks so that everybody can see what's right and who was wrong, right? God chooses to hold off on that public judgment and on public judgment on a host of other things too. God chooses to hold off on that judgment until the day when all things, both the external things, like who had what tangible success, and the internal things, like the thoughts and intentions of people's hearts, when all the things, external and internal, will be laid out plainly on the table for everyone to see exactly what they really are. And Paul says that in the meantime, if God refrains from public judgment, then it's not our place to jump to conclusions. And that's what we kind of do in our impatience. If God would step up and say what he thought, we'd be happy to keep our mouths shut. But if God's going to just stay silent, well, we may as well say what we think. And Paul says, but we are to make no assessments or conclusions before the appointed time. Wait till the Lord comes. He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of people's hearts. And at that time, he says, each will receive his praise from the Lord. Now, it's interesting. What do you notice right off about that? He doesn't say each will receive his praise or condemnation. It's interesting that Paul doesn't say that there will be praise or rebuke. And part of this is because here we're not talking about the great judgment of the living and the dead. Here we're not talking about people being judged for their lives. Here we're talking about those who had been called to Christian service, specifically the apostles, but then others in a similar and lesser degree, appearing before the Lord to present their lives that were offered up to him. This is the assessment that the Lord makes of the gifts given to him by those who loved him. This is the assessment that the Lord will make of the service that has been rendered up to him, like we see in the first two servants in the parable of the talents. The one who entirely by the grace of God achieves much, receives praise from the Lord he served. And the one who by the grace of God achieved a little, receives praise from the Lord whom he loved. When service is rendered in love, it is evaluated in terms of what the person can offer, not in terms of what the person can't offer. Now this, of course, this Paul's kind of hammering away here that no one has the right to judge. That's not the whole story, of course, about judging or discerning about people in leadership and ministry. Okay? Because Paul here is not talking about some concrete moral failure. And he's also not talking about investigating the question as to whether or not someone has been called to service, right? Paul's choosing as an apostle and his call to service had already been amply proven. They were not questioning whether or not he was an apostle, just was he the right apostle. When it comes out that a Christian leader is sending inappropriate text messages, or appropriating ministry funds for personal use, or running a church or parachurch ministry by manipulative, coercive, abusive means, that person needs to be removed from ministry. That person needs to be assessed and judged. And they need to be removed from ministry and should not be returned to it for a long time, if at all. I don't know who follows the news. I'm unfortunately on mailing lists that of people who keep track of abuses in ministry. And it is shocking, the current thing nowadays, when some big name person with a podcast and a big pulpit and everything, when they really blow it and they're removed from ministry, it's about 4 to 6 weeks before they are back with two or three other big name pastors telling how sincerely this man has repented, and we've done a thorough process of restoration, and we encourage you to show him the love and grace of God, because our God is a God of second chances. And people get away with it. But that sort of thing, that is not the situation that Paul is talking about here. Okay? Similarly, when we talk about no one has the right to judge because only God calls, a lot of, I won't say a lot of, there are denominations where the only thing they care about in order to ordain someone to the ministry is, do they have a call? And it is sufficient if the person says, you know, I really feel called to ministry, then the response is, then who are we to judge? But if the person, you know, their life is a mess, right? They've barely pulled themselves together in the last year or two, right? Their understanding of the gospel is questionable, right? Then yes, it is the job of the church to question that call and to ask questions and to dive in and find out, you know, what's really going through this person's, is what you say is a call to ministry, do we believe is a call to ministry, right? The church is called to judge in that way. But again, that is not what Paul is talking about. Paul's call to ministry is beyond question. If the Corinthians need any proof, as he says later, they are the proof. And he's also not talking about any sort of moral failure. He has said that his conscience is clear, and he's not being accused by the Corinthians of any sort of moral failure. What he is talking about is he is being judged by criteria borrowed from the world, criteria of ability, criteria of style, criteria of how impressive he comes across, Instagram criteria, criteria that God has said he cares nothing about. Criteria that mean nothing if someone has understood what God did at the cross. The problem isn't that Paul has done anything wrong or that they doubt that God has called him to ministry. The problem is that he simply isn't what the Corinthians want. And so his response is basically, too bad, I'm what God gave you. God has filled his church with very human humans. And that's true whether we're talking about pastors or youth or children's workers, music leaders, council members, people in leadership, trustees, people who do cleaning and maintenance in the building, people who handles or oversee some other part of the work of the church, right? None of us are the perfect person to knock it out of the park. We all stumble along in the roles that we're called to. We are all, like Moses, stuttering the word of God. Augustine famously said that the church is like a hospital for sinners. And the problem with that analogy is that it's worse than that. Because in the hospital, the doctors aren't sick, right? The people taking care of the sick people are themselves okay, right? And the church is much more like a leper colony. We've all got the same problem. And somehow, God is at work among us, enabling us to help one another. And so all of us need to learn to look for what God can do, not for what the person can do. Yes, we take into account strengths and weaknesses and gifting and abilities and all that kind of stuff. But in all of that, what we're really looking for is what God can do and what God is doing in one another. To regard one another as servants of Christ. And no matter how little that person impresses you, If they are in the church, then God put them here to help you. That should just absolutely be one of these foundational things that's always in the back of your head. Often when I talk with people about how important it is to be connected with a church, I don't talk about how the person needs church. I think they do need church, but what I'm more far likely to talk about is that the church needs them. If God has assigned you here or anywhere else, we can't be us without you. God's work is hampered when we don't step up and respond to where we're called to be. How little impressive any of us are, if we're here, we are here because God wants to use us to help one another. And so we learn to look at one another with the expectation of what God will do. We need one another. But behind that is the deeper truth that we don't need one another. Ellen, I really like you, but I don't actually need you. But I desperately need God in you. When I go to small group, I enjoy being with my brothers and sisters. I enjoy hearing what's going on in their life, but I don't need that. I'm an introvert. I'd rather go down cellar and be by myself. But I desperately want what God is doing in their lives, because he's doing it in their lives, not only for them, but for me as well. We need to learn to see one another simultaneously in two ways. Fully expecting one another to be proved to be no more than clay pots, not porcelain vases, just human beings doing their best, which most of the time really isn't much. But at the same time, we simultaneously look at people aware that if God has given that person a role, then God will be at work in them. Somewhere in that earthen vessel, there is the light of the gospel, the Spirit of God at work. So that in some mind-blowing way, their perhaps substandard efforts really do achieve God's purposes. And the same goes for judging someone else as well as looking at yourself. We don't judge others, we don't judge ourselves. We listen closely for what God's call is, and we trust and obey. And in others, we look carefully for what it is that God is doing, because he is doing something there. Amen.